The United States, as the world knows, will never start a war. We do not want a war. We do not now expect a war. This generation of Americans has already had enough, more than enough, of war and hate and oppression.
William Luther Pierce on The Jewish Problem, 1997.
Hello. A few weeks ago, I spoke with you about the ongoing Jewish extortion effort against Switzerland. Jewish organizations claimed that Swiss banks were holding onto assets deposited by wealthy Jews in the 1930s and 1940s who later perished during the Second World War and so were never able to retrieve their money. Jews demanded that this money be put into a special fund for so-called Holocaust survivors. More information has come to light about this Jewish extortion campaign, and I want to share it with you today because it helps us to understand better the situation all of us are in. In the first place, let us be clear on the point that what we are talking about is not simply an effort by Jews to get back what rightfully belongs to them. It is not a matter of aging Holocaust survivors, David and Sarah Goldblatt in Miami Beach, trying to get their hands on an account their late Uncle Abe set up in Switzerland before he was hauled off to Auschwitz in 1943 and never seen again. It is, in fact, a massive campaign of criminal extortion, complete with threats, deception, and fraud on a huge scale, and criminal collusion by the Clinton government and the control news media. As I told you when I talked about this earlier, the initial response of the Swiss to the Jewish demand for money was that Jewish depositors always had been treated just like all other depositors, and that Swiss bankers already had investigated their dormant accounts and looked for rightful owners, and that there was, at most, a few million dollars in such accounts, which might belong to relatives of Jews who had died during the war. All David and Sarah Goldblatt had to do to claim Uncle Abe's money was present evidence that it was rightfully theirs. Now this, of course, wasn't what the Jews had in mind at all, and so they began applying pressure and making threats. Switzerland's president at the time, Jean-Pascal Delamuraz, angrily accused the Jews of blackmail and extortion in trying to pressure Switzerland to turn money over to them without any evidence that they had a legitimate claim. But, unfortunately, Mr. Delamuraz was leaving office at the end of 1996, and his successor was more willing to pay blackmail in order to avoid trouble. Just to make sure that the Swiss got the message, the Jews persuaded some of their Christian collaborators to join their campaign. Willing church leaders in Switzerland organized a public demonstration in Zurich by 15,000 churchgoers who demanded that the Swiss government and the Swiss bankers give God's chosen people whatever they wanted and stop accusing the poor, persecuted Jews of blackmail. The Swiss bankers and the Swiss politicians are a bit more hard-headed than these pale, soft, hymn-singing churchgoers, however. Arguments that God's chosen people deserve whatever they want because the Bible says so have little effect on them. The real pressure was being applied to them out of the public's eye. On January 10th of this year, billionaire Jewish liquor merchant Edgar Bronfman, head of the World Jewish Congress, met with the Swiss ambassador to the United States and threatened him that unless Switzerland coughed up $250 million immediately, upcoming congressional hearings by the House Banking Committee would be made as embarrassing as possible for Switzerland. And other pressure was being applied behind the scenes. A group of New York Jews claiming to be Holocaust victims brought a class action suit against three of Switzerland's largest banks and petitioned the Federal Reserve Bank of New York to suspend the banking licenses of the defendant banks pending the outcome of the lawsuit. If such a petition were granted, it would cause the banks to lose billions of dollars. Israel got into the campaign when the Jewish agency, headquartered in Jerusalem, hinted that it would call for a worldwide boycott of Swiss banks if the former Swiss president didn't apologize for characterizing the Jewish campaign as extortion. The result of this threat was the apology which had been demanded, and Mr. Clinton's State Department has been cooperating with the campaign by releasing a series of World War II documents, one every week or so, purporting to show that the Swiss were cozy with the Germans during the war. The release of these documents at this time is clearly a ploy calculated to embarrass Switzerland and put pressure on that country to bow to Jewish demands for more and more money. The Swiss already have coughed up the $250 million demanded by Bronfman, and now the Jews are indicating that that is just the first payment. They are suggesting that $7 billion may be a reasonable total amount for Switzerland to pay the Jews. And the Jews claim that they can't understand why so many people hate them. Well, it is clear in this case that the Jews will go for just as much money as they figure they can extort from the Swiss, and not a shekel less. And it is the shekels which count with them, not how many more people learn to hate them as a consequence of this behavior. That's the way it's always been with them. Of course, in this case, it's hard to feel sorry for the Swiss, because they chose to capitulate to the extortion rather than to fight, which is what the Jews calculated they would do. In this democratic era, there just don't seem to be politicians or businessmen anywhere with principles or a sense of honor. Another interesting example of the Jews' characteristic of pushing ahead arrogantly with whatever they believe is advantageous to them without any concern for the hatred which their behavior generates came to my attention recently. The great fad these days, of course, the great media-promoted craze is diversity, and Jews are to be found in every nook and cranny of the diversity movement. Jews produce the diversity propaganda. They agitate for new diversity legislation, and they always are pushing to cram more diversity down our throats. If they see any group of white people, the residents of an apartment building, students in a school classroom, a sports team, a Saturday night poker club, any all-white group, they will try to force the group to accept three Zulus, a Chinaman, and a disabled Hispanic lesbian. The idea, of course, is to exterminate us, to wage genocide against us, to leave us with no opportunity to be among our own kind, no opportunity to feel a sense of kinship and belonging among our own people, no opportunity to organize and defend ourselves. They want to be the one and only self-conscious group on this earth, able to act intelligently in promoting their group interests. And then the world will belong to them. And you know, they've been pretty successful so far in their campaign against us. They've been successful because they've kept their motives moderately well concealed, and they've been able to persuade large segments of our own people to collaborate with them in their diversity campaign by convincing them that it's the moral thing to do. The hymn singers are an example. But you know, sometimes their arrogance just runs away with itself and blows their cover. They put out a newsletter called Managing Diversity, which goes to all of the government agencies in Washington. It tells the bureaucrats how they can increase the amount of diversity in their bailiwicks and still keep things under control. It tells them how they can displace more normal white government workers with Hmong tribesmen or wetbacks or AIDS-inflicted alternate lifestylers and still keep the remaining whites from rebelling. In addition to this sort of practical advice, managing diversity also has a lot of sensitivity training articles in its issues. Articles which are supposed to be posted for the white workers to read in order to keep them feeling guilty and cowed. An example is a front page article in a recent issue of Managing Diversity, written by Harris Sussman, Ph.D. Dr. Sussman's article is titled, "What Are the Values of White People?" And then this too clever and too arrogant Jewish diversity promoter turns and bites the very hymn singers who have collaborated with him and his kind most eagerly. He writes, and I quote, "It turns out that the white people we are talking about have been primarily Christians, often acting in the name of their Christian values. In the name of Christian values, they had the Inquisition. They called native peoples savages who did not qualify as human beings. They set up definitions of pagans, heathens, primitives, undeveloped people, which left Christians superior and dominant. They killed Jews and gypsies in the Holocaust. In our postmodern vocabulary, whites, or the white man, is all we need to say to invoke this history and experience of injustice and cruelty. When we say white people, we mean the people who value things over people, who value money over people. We know exactly what their values are and where they lead. We have all paid a terrible price for those values." Close quote. Remember, this is a Jew telling us that we Gentiles are too interested in money. In the same article, Dr. Sussman goes on to gloat over what he and his kind already have done to white people with their brainwashing campaign. He gloats over the psychological and spiritual damage his diversity campaign already has caused. And again, I quote, "Many white people are uneasy with their own history. They are having a profound identity crisis. This means that many white people do not think of themselves as white people," he crows. And then he describes the many ways in which guilt-stricken whites are trying to escape from their own identity and conform to what Sussman and his fellow Jews want them to be. He writes that many confused white people are trying to, quote, "adopt the values of native peoples. Look at ecofeminism," he says. "Look at holistic health, Earth Day, the rainbow gathering," end quote. That's from the newsletter Managing Diversity, copies of which can be found in every government workplace in Washington. Sussman figures that the hymn singers will let him kick them in the teeth and then will lick his toes and beg for another kick. And unfortunately, that's exactly what many of them will do. There's a sort of masochistic tendency among many of them. But there are a lot of us white people who aren't masochists. A lot of us unreconstructed white boys who don't react to Dr. Sussman and his kind the way they want us to. A lot of us who read what he has to say and then make a pledge to ourselves that one day we'll see him and all of his kind swinging and jerking at the end of a rope, no matter what it takes. And you know, there are some old-fashioned Christians among us, too, who'll be helping us haul on the other end of that rope. These two examples of Jewish behavior I've given, the brazen extortion of hundreds of millions of dollars from the Swiss people, and the arrogant gloating about the damage they have done to us with their diversity campaign. These two examples lead us to a closely related subject we've discussed on earlier programs, and that is the so-called Holocaust. We've looked at various aspects of their Holocaust propaganda in the past, and we've uncovered some of their little psychological tricks, such as calling anyone who doesn't swallow the whole myth, lock, stock, and barrel, a Holocaust denier. If you question any of their numbers about how many Jews supposedly were put into gas chambers, if you question a single one of their overblown atrocity stories, then you're a Holocaust denier, implying that you believe that the Germans took no defensive measures at all against the Jews during the Second World War, when in fact you know that the Germans did try to rid themselves of Jewish influence. We've examined some of these tricks of theirs, and we've explored some of their specific lies about the Holocaust, but the question remains, why do they do it? Why do they push the Holocaust business so hard? Why, 55 years after the fact, do they keep playing the same tune? Why do they demand that the American taxpayers provide free land for Holocaust museums for them? Why do they demand that our children in the public schools be subjected to Holocaust propaganda courses? They are aware that many other peoples have gone through their own Holocausts. The Armenians, the Germans, the Ukrainians, the Russians. Why is it only the Jews who keep pushing it? Only the Jews who make it the focus of their lives, the essential core of their identity? Well, we really know the answer to this question now. We understand that they push the Holocaust for two reasons. First, because they make lots and lots of money from it. And second, because it protects them from criticism, enables them to get away with the most outrageous behavior, behavior that would not be tolerated in any other people. They have just collected $250 million in cold, hard cash from the Swiss in blackmail money. Money which the Swiss gave to them not because there was the slightest evidence that the Jews were entitled to any of it, but simply to avoid a boycott. And the Jews are aiming for $7 billion more from the Swiss the same way. Anybody else who tried a stunt like that would end up in prison for extortion. The Swiss government wouldn't have caved in to anybody else either. If, for example, the heirs of the Russian aristocrats who were butchered by Jewish communists in the 1920s had made a similar demand on the Swiss bankers for lost assets, the Swiss would have fought them all the way. But they didn't want to fight the Jews. They even apologized for frankly telling the Jews what they thought about the whole racket, because they knew the Jews would wrap themselves in the Holocaust, and it would look like the Swiss were picking on the poor, innocent, defenseless, persecuted dears. They knew the Jews had them beat at the propaganda game, at the sympathy game. That's just one example of the cash value of the Holocaust. Another example is the $4 billion in American taxpayers' money which goes to the Jews in Israel every year, and the tens of billions of dollars the Jews have extorted from the German people over the past 50 years. Or consider Dr. Sussman's boasting about the damage the Jews' diversity propaganda already has done to the self-image of many gullible white people. Who else but a Jew would have the brass for that? And where does that brass come from? It comes from a sure knowledge that he can retreat into his victim status if anyone calls him to account. He knows that he can invoke the Holocaust, that he can wrap himself in the Holocaust, and his accusers will retreat in embarrassment. At least the hymn singers will retreat in embarrassment, and any harder-headed critic of the Jews or their behavior or their influence knows that he will be regarded as a bully by everyone who has been taken in by the Holocaust propaganda. But the fact is that we do have a Jewish problem in America. It is by far the biggest and most dangerous problem we have. It is worse than our crime problem, worse than our drug problem, worse than our political corruption problem, worse than our immigration problem, worse even than our race problem. Our Jewish problem, in fact, lies at the root of nearly all of our other problems. If we are to have a future, we must solve it. We cannot let ourselves be buffaloed by the Holocaust. We must face the fact that, regardless of all the nice, inoffensive Jews you may know as individuals, all of the Jews who mind their own business, the Jews as a whole are destroying our society. Their policies are poison to us. And with their control of our news and entertainment media, and their corollary control of our political system, they have a death grip on our country. We must have the courage to stand up to them and to do everything necessary to break that death grip. We must free our media and our government from their influence. We must make an example of the Sussmans and all of their collaborators. Otherwise, they will destroy us as surely as they have destroyed every other society in which they were given free rein. Think about it. But whatever you decide to do, do it. Get in touch with me, and let's do it together. Thanks for being with me again today.
Dr. William Luther Pierce, 1997, The Feminization of America.
Hello. I always have been very fond of women, perhaps too much sometimes. I always have enjoyed their company greatly. I have really worshipped feminine beauty. I have admired and respected women when they have served their natural purpose in the life of our people, as much as I have admired and respected men who have served their purpose. Having said this, I must tell you now that I believe that a great part of the present pathology of our society can be ascribed properly to its feminization over the past century or two, to its loss of its former masculine spirit and masculine character. This came to mind most recently when I saw and heard the reaction to Timothy McVeigh's statement to the court on August 14th, at the time he was sentenced to die. What McVeigh said was very relevant, very pertinent. He said that the government teaches its citizens by its example. When the government breaks the law, then its citizens will not respect the law. But the spectators almost uniformly were disappointed by this statement. They complained that they wanted to hear him say that he was sorry for what he had done, that he was sorry for the innocent victims of the Oklahoma City bombing. They weren't even interested in hearing about the much larger issue of government lawlessness that Mr. McVeigh raised. They only wanted an apology for the suffering of the individual victims. Now, that is a feminine attitude, this focusing on personal and individual feelings rather than on the larger and more impersonal context. That attitude is a feminine one, despite the fact that it was expressed by grown men. Many, many other people besides me have come to similar conclusions, although not all of them have wanted to come right out and say so, because that would be the height of political incorrectness, the height of insensitivity. I remember as far back as the 1960s, some perceptive commentators remarking on the generally unmasculine character of the young men they encountered in our universities. Male university students even then tended to be too timid, too soft, too lacking in boldness and pride and independence, too whiny in adversity, insufficiently willing to endure hardship or to challenge obstacles. We have, of course, always had both soft, dependent men and hard, proud men in our society. But the commentators were comparing the relative numbers of masculine and non-masculine men they saw in our universities in the 1960s with what they had seen in the 1930s and 1940s. The 1960s, of course, were a time when the whinier men were making extraordinary efforts to remain in the universities in order to avoid military service, while many of the more masculine men were off in Vietnam. But this isn't enough to account for the change these commentators noticed. Something written by the American historian Henry Adams back in 1913 was recently called to my attention. Adams wrote, and I quote, "Our age has lost much of its ear for poetry, as it has its eye for color and line, and its taste for war and worship, wine and women." End of quote. Now, Henry Adams was a man who had much more than a passing interest in such matters. He was a lifelong student of these things, and also was a professor of history at Harvard, back in the days when the professors at that university were expected to know what they were talking about. So we ought to pay some attention to his observation of the state of affairs in America in 1913. Incidentally, he was a member of one of America's most distinguished families. He was a great-grandson of the founding father and second president of the country, John Adams, and a grandson of the sixth president, John Quincy Adams. Actually, Henry's brother, Brooks Adams, had written a book 18 years earlier, in 1895, on the subject commented on by Henry. It was The Law of Civilization and Decay. And in it, Brooks made an even more general observation than that stated later by Henry. Brooks saw two types of man, the type he described as spiritual man, typified by the farmer, warrior, poet, priest, and the type he called economic man, typified by the merchant and the bureaucrat. I believe that Brooks must have known a different breed of priests than those I'm familiar with. He was thinking of Martin Luther and Giordano Bruno, not Billy Graham and John Paul II. He saw a spiritual man as having the leading role in the building of a civilization, with the economic men coming out of the woodwork and assuming the dominant role after the civilization had peaked and was in the process of decay. Spiritual men are those with vision and daring and a close connection to their roots, to their spiritual sources. Economic men are those who know how to calculate the odds and evaluate an opportunity, but who have cut themselves loose from their spiritual roots and become cosmopolitans to the extent that that offers an economic advantage. The spirit of adventure and the current of idealism run strong in spiritual men. Economic men, on the other hand, are materialists. And of course, Brooks was referring only to European men, to white men. He was not even considering Jews or Chinamen. Most of us are a mixture of the two types, and it's difficult to find examples of purely spiritual or purely economic men. Michelangelo and Charles Lindbergh tended toward the type of spiritual man. Pick almost any prominent politician today, Bill Clinton or Newt Gingrich, say, and you have a good example of economic man, which is not to say that all economic men are politicians by any means, just that since they are not likely to be distinguished in the arts or in scholarship or in exploration, politics is where economic men are most likely to find fame. So what does this have to do with the feminization of our society and the preponderance of whiny young men at our universities today? Actually, these things are very closely interrelated, as we shall see. And they also are related to the things which caught the attention of Henry Adams, the loss of our aesthetic sense, our warrior spirit, and our feeling for what is divine, along with our masculinity. When I say loss, I'm using this word only in its relative sense. Our society still has masculine elements, masculine characteristics. It's just that they are weaker now than they were 200 years ago. And 200 years ago, there were some effeminate tendencies to be found, tendencies which today have become much more pronounced. It would be an error, I believe, to attribute this shift in balance solely to the machinations of feminists or homosexuals or even Jews. They are responsible for the condition of our society today, primarily in the sense that the pus in a right boil is to be blamed for the boil. The feminists and the homosexuals and the Jews characterize our society in large part today. They are symptoms of the pathology afflicting our society. But we must look deeper for the cause of our decay. Let me repeat Henry Adams' observation. He wrote, "Our age has lost much of its ear for poetry, as it has its eye for color and line, and its taste for war and worship, wine and women." If he were writing today, he might note that the immortal lyrics of his contemporary Tennyson have given way in public favor to the pretentious drivel of Maya Angelou, that the Western tradition in art, which had culminated in the 19th century in the paintings of Caspar David Friedrich and John Constable, has been shoved aside in the 20th century by the trash art of Picasso and Chagall and Pollock, that the profession of arms, which was still a more or less honorable profession in the 19th century, a profession in which gentlemen and even scholars still could be found, has become at the end of the 20th century a vocation for bureaucrats and lickspittles, for men without honor or spirit. That worship, once taken seriously even by many intelligent and sophisticated men, is now the business of Christian Democrats with their egalitarian social gospel, and of vulgarians of the Jim and Tammy Faye Baker stripe with their television congregations of superstitious, amen-shouting dimwits. So now, can we properly describe this change noted by Henry Adams as the feminization of our society? Or should it be thought of as the replacement of aristocratic values by democratic values, a general vulgarization of standards and tastes? Actually, these two ways of looking at the changes are related. But let me take Brooks Adams' position now and say that the change can be attributed most fundamentally to the growing materialism in our society, to the replacement of spiritual values by economic values. What does that have to do with feminism or with democracy? Actually, a great deal. In a very broad sense, aristocratic values are masculine values, and democratic values, egalitarian values, are feminine values. It is also true that in a very broad sense, materialism is a feminine way of looking at the world. It is a way which puts emphasis on safety and security and comfort, and on tangible things at the expense of intangibles. It is not concerned at all with concepts such as honor, and very little with beauty and tradition and roots. It is a way with a limited horizon, with the home and hearth very much in sight, but not distant from tears. Reverence and awe for nature's majesty are unknown to the materialist. As spiritual man gives way to economic man when one historical era merges into another, as idealism gives way to materialism, society gives a freer play to the feminine spirit while it restricts the masculine spirit. Words gain over deeds. Action gives way to talk. Quantity is valued over quality. All of God's children are loved equally. Pickaninnies are considered cute or even adorable. The role of the government shifts from that of a father who maintains an orderly and lawful environment in which men are free to strive for success as little or as much as suits them, to that of a mother who wants to ensure that all of her children will be supplied with whatever they need. And of course, it is not just society which changes, not just government, not just public policy. Individual attitudes and behavior also change. The way in which children are raised changes. Girls no longer are raised to be mothers and homemakers, but rather to be self-indulgent careerists. Boys no longer are raised to be strong-willed and independent and resourceful, because that requires hardness and self-denial. It requires masculine rule during the formative years. A disciplined environment gives way to a permissive one, and so the child does not learn self-discipline. Spanking becomes a criminal offense. The child is not punished for disobedience, nor is he given the opportunity to fail and to learn from this the penalties that the real world holds for those who are not strong enough to succeed. And so boys grow up to be whiny and ineffective young men who believe that a plausible excuse is an acceptable substitute for performance, and who never can understand why the gratification they seek eludes them. The move from masculine idealism to feminine materialism leads inevitably to hedonism and egoism. Eventually, to narcissism. Henry Adams also claimed that we have lost our taste for wine and women. Well, certainly not in the sense that we have become less interested in alcohol or sex. What he meant is that we have lost the keen edge of our appreciation for civilization's refinements, for the finest and most subtle things in life. That our appetites have become grosser as they have become less disciplined. Our interest now is in alcohol for its ability to give us a momentary buzz, not in fine wine for its inherent artistry. And a similar consideration applies to the way in which our taste for women has changed. And is this not to be expected? It is the masculine spirit which appreciates woman, which appreciates feminine qualities. And as this spirit declines, our taste for women loses its edge and becomes coarser. We move from an age in which women were not only appreciated, but also treasured and protected, into an age in which homosexuality is open, tolerated, and increasingly common. Madonna is a celebrated symbol of American womanhood, and feminine beauty is a mere commodity like soybeans or crude oil. An age in which parents dump their daughters into the multiracial cesspool that America's schools and cities have become to let them fend for themselves, and are expected not to say anything negative when they begin whoring with the descendants of our African slaves. In an age in which materialism and feminism are ascendant, this is the only way it can be. to attempt to make it otherwise, to attempt to decommercialize sex, for example, would be a blow against the economy, against the materialist spirit. And to elevate women again to the protected status they had in a more masculine era would be fought tooth and nail by the feminists as a limitation on women's freedom. You know, the subject I've been speaking about today is a little fuzzy, and I've been speaking qualitatively rather than quantitatively. For almost everything I've said, an opponent could produce a counterexample. And that's because I'm talking about very large-scale phenomena involving many people, many institutions, and many types of interactions. Even during periods of history which I would characterize as masculine or as dominated by the masculine spirit, one can find examples of feminine tendencies and of institutions with a feminine spirit, just as one can find masculine tendencies in our society today. For example, while I claim that our society is becoming more effeminate today, someone can attempt to counter that by noting that masculinized women are more prominent today. Female lawyers, female executives, female military officers. And one can attribute that to masculine influences in our society. I would counter that by saying that when men become less masculine, women become less feminine. Likewise, when I relate materialism and feminism, or when I say that the rise of the economic spirit is associated with a decline in masculinity, someone else can find plenty of men with no shortage of testosterone, strong, aggressive capitalists, who are epitomes of what Brooks Adams called economic man. What it really amounts to is that the masculine character, like the feminine character, has many components. The component I have emphasized today is the spiritual component. And, of course, there are other components. It is a complex subject. But I still believe that we can meaningfully describe what has happened to our society and our civilization during the past couple of centuries as a decline in masculinity. I believe that such a description sheds a useful light on one aspect of what has happened to us. And I believe that Henry Adams' comment on our society's loss of its artistic sense and of the sense of reverence along with its warrior spirit is a generally true statement which has value in helping us to understand our predicament. Adams, to be sure, was a scholar of considerable depth, and he wrote a great deal of carefully reasoned material to support the one-sentence summary which I quoted. By the way, one subject with which Henry Adams and his brother Brooks, too, were familiar in this regard was the role of the Jew in undermining civilization. Henry made a number of comments about the destructive role of the Jews in the economic and cultural aspects of European civilization. His observations on this subject are perhaps best summed up by something he wrote in a letter to a friend in 1896. "The Jew," he wrote, "has got into the soul, and wherever he," that is the Jew, "goes, there must remain a taint in the blood forever." End of quote. How much worse that taint has become during the century since Henry Adams made that observation. Well, I apologize for being so abstract in my own comments today. I promise that in my next broadcast, I'll be more concrete. I'll talk about specific events, people, dates, places, and so on. But I do believe that it's useful to back off every now and then and try to see the big picture, to try to develop an intuitive sort of understanding of our situation, even if it means talking about things which are by their nature somewhat fuzzy. Thanks for being with me again today.
Dr. William Luther Pierce, 1997. The New World Order.
Hello. We've discussed many topics on these American Dissident Voices programs. We've talked about social issues, moral issues, political issues. We've talked about race and about nationalism and about the Jewish control of the news and entertainment media and about many other things. Today I'll talk about the big picture. I'll talk in broad outline about the salient developments of the past few years and the way in which they affect our people. There's been much talk in various quarters recently about the New World Order. Until 7 or 8 years ago, the New World Order was a poorly kept secret. It was discussed in private by the people who considered themselves qualified to decide for all the rest of us what sort of world we wanted to live in, but they didn't often let us in on their discussions. They were concerned that in our backwardness and ignorance, we might not want to go along for the ride if we learned what these elitists had planned for us. Nowadays, however, with Bill Clinton in the White House and the general public dancing mindlessly to whatever tune is played by the mass media, they are much less concerned that the hoi polloi will be able to upset their apple cart. And so the New World Order is discussed within earshot of us commoners as a matter of course. Despite this general familiarity with the term, however, there is very little real understanding on the part of most people of the concept of a New World Order. And there is even less understanding of the real motivations behind this concept and of their historical development. I'll try to remedy this lack of understanding, at least in some small part, during the next few minutes. Let's look at the history of the New World Order concept first. The idea of a world government certainly isn't new, of course. The Roman Empire achieved a world government to a large extent 2,000 years ago. And during the Middle Ages, the Christian Church constituted a universal order of sorts, despite the schism between its Western or Roman branch and its Eastern or Greek branch. In modern times, the idea has appealed to several groups of people. In the first place, there are the amoral, super wealthy elements, cosmopolitan and raceless individuals who already wield a great deal of power through their wealth and like to flatter themselves with the thought that they deserve even more power over the lives of the rest of us. Actually, in many cases, there's more than self-flattery involved. Many of these men are involved in giant multinational business enterprises, and they see more profit for themselves in the conversion of the world into a sort of global plantation, with themselves in the role of owners and overseers, and the rest of us as their serfs. These cosmopolitan big business elements are the elements that most of the unsophisticated opponents of the New World Order think about. Often these unsophisticated opponents simply rail against the international bankers and attribute to them the dominant role in New World Order scheming. At least as important as these super wealthy big business elements, however, and vastly more numerous, are those who support the New World Order for reasons of ideology or fashion. The idea of a world government has had a trendy sort of appeal among leftist academics and clerics, as well as among a number of shallow intellectuals influenced by the former and Christians influenced by the latter. Bill and Hillary Clinton, as well as many of their friends and associates, are among the former. The New World Order has been fashionable among the crowd they have run with since high school, And these people are nothing if not fashion conscious. They are people who would rather be torn apart by wild horses than be caught with an unfashionable idea in their heads. Many of the Christian supporters of the New World Order are tormented by feelings of white racial guilt or of misplaced compassion for the non-white hordes of the world. They see the New World Order as a way to equalize the world racially by redistributing the world's wealth and to punish the whites by bringing them down to the level of the non-whites. Also among the ideological boosters of the New World Order are those who claim to see greater security for everyone under a world government, or who are simply attracted by the concept of a more orderly world under centralized control. Since the early part of this century, groups such as the Council on Foreign Relations have been working behind the scenes on the political and the academic fronts to promote the idea of a new world order. These people argue that with weapons of mass destruction, such as nuclear bombs, on the loose, the only way for humanity to be safe is under a world government. Only through the establishment of a new world order, they assert, can we hope to eliminate war and its associated evils. Yet these same intellectuals were hotter than anyone else to unleash the Second World War, the most destructive and murderous war ever inflicted on the world, and to develop and use nuclear weapons in that war. Their conspiring and their behind-the-scenes maneuvering succeeded in turning a regional conflict in Eastern Europe, primarily between Germany and the Soviet Union, into a global campaign to destroy Germany and save the Soviet Union. Their great disappointment was that the war in Europe ended too soon for them to use nuclear weapons against Germany. Despite their professed abhorrence of war, they are all too ready to resort to it in order to prevent what they consider the wrong sort of New World Order, or even the wrong sort of New European Order. And this brings us to a third element, and the most important element, among the proponents of the New World Order. This is the Jewish element. Anyone who reads the Old Testament with eyes not blinded by Christian piety cannot miss its central message. The Jews are a special people who are morally superior to the other peoples of the earth, a chosen people, chosen by their tribal deity to inherit the earth and all its riches, and to be served by non-Jews. Isaiah, for example, spells out this message clearly and explicitly. Orthodox religious Jews believe it literally. Even atheistic Jews believe it, in a sense. They believe that they are smarter, more resourceful, and better organized than non-Jews, and so deserve to exploit them and rule over them. And at least as far as being better organized, they certainly are correct. They have 10 times as many organizations per capita to represent their interests as any other race or ethnic group. Some of these are strictly internal, educational, or cultural organizations aimed at maintaining Jewish cohesiveness and the Jewish sense of identity. Others are aimed at exerting pressure or influence on the Gentile majorities around them. Some of these latter organizations, such as the Anti-Defamation League of B'nai B'rith, are quite powerful and have Gentile politicians dancing to their tune. And in a collective sense, the Jews may be justified in thinking that they are smarter, which is to say that they have developed a collective strategy for survival and self-advancement, which so far has been extraordinarily successful. Central to this strategy is the maintenance of a sense of grievance against the non-Jewish world, a sense that Jews not only must stick together, but that they are justified in using deceit and any other tactic in their dealings with the Gentiles, because the Gentiles are out to destroy them. Certainly no other race celebrates its alleged persecutions the way the Jews do theirs. In their annual Purim festival, for example, they still nurse a 2,500-year-old grievance against the ancient Persians. More than anything else, however, it is the Jews' control of the news and entertainment media which gives them their immense power. And for more than 50 years, they have consistently used their media power to advance the schemes of the New World Order gang. Clearly, the Jews see a dominant role for themselves in a world government because of the power they already wield. Beyond this, with their highly leveraged situation, that is, their need to maintain their control over numerically much larger Gentile populations everywhere, increasing centralization of governmental power is the only strategy which makes sense for them. They have a tiger by the tail, and they dare not let go. Their great fear is that a strong and genuinely patriotic leader may arise in some nation, another Adolf Hitler, and he will succeed in breaking the Jewish control over his people and ending Jewish power in his nation. If that is permitted to happen in any major nation, it may spread quickly to other nations. That is why they pulled out all the stops to destroy Germany during the Second World War. And, if they were not already convinced, the Second World War redoubled their conviction that they must make every nation subordinate to a world government under their control. What the Jews and the other New World Order schemers have in mind goes far, far beyond the United Nations organization that they created at the end of the Second World War. The UN has been moderately successful at bullying small countries into line with the threat of the so-called peacekeeping forces which they employ, but it has no power at all over large nations. The Jews want a final end to the possibility of the resurgence of any nationalism, except their own, of course. They want to eliminate forever the possibility that the people of Russia, or the United States, or Germany, or Britain, or any other country except Israel will act of their own will. The total elimination of national sovereignty is in accord with the interests of the non-Jewish New World Order schemers as well. The whole idea of patriotism has been in bad odor with the leftist academics and their semi-intellectual hangers-on for a long time. Patriotism is an alien concept to them. They are instinctively hostile to patriots. Bill Clinton, who demonstrated against his own country during the Vietnam War, provides an excellent example of this mindset. And patriotism also is contrary to the universalist ideas of the Christian clerics backing the New World Order. Finally, the international capitalists also are hostile to national sovereignty. They want a truly global plantation with a global labor pool for them to exploit and a global market for them to milk. National boundaries and any tendencies toward protecting national interests just get in their way and cut into their profits. So now we can begin to understand some of the things which have been happening to us during the past few decades in terms of these goals of the New World Order schemers. For example, the refusal of the United States government to control our borders. We have millions of illegal aliens in the United States and hundreds of thousands more entering the country every year. Stopping the flow of illegal aliens across our borders and deporting the illegals already here would be a trivially easy thing for the United States government to do. It would cost far less money than is spent each year in providing various social and medical services to these illegal aliens now. Any military or police operations involved could be integrated with training programs and could provide valuable experience for military and police personnel. But the federal government has consistently refused to take any effective action to halt illegal immigration. They have simply play-acted in this regard, spending a tiny amount of money to beef up a security fence along the Mexican border in one area and leaving the border unguarded in another area. In response to public outrage by citizens in border areas who demand action by the government, a few dozen more Border Patrol agents will be hired, or some other action will be taken to make it seem that the government wants to control the borders. But every action taken is deliberately ineffective, and I mean deliberately. The truth of the matter is that the New World Order people ultimately aim to create a new world population of serfs for their global plantation, a homogeneous population of coffee-colored serfs, a population of docile and predictable and interchangeable serfs, and they definitely don't want any large reservoir of white people anywhere who might rebel. So from the point of view of the New World Order planners, the more Mexicans and Haitians and Vietnamese who pour into the United States, the better. But they are not ready yet to announce publicly that their aim is to destroy the racial character of the U.S. population. So when the citizens squawk too loudly about illegal aliens, the government puts on a pretense of doing something about the problem. What they want to do is keep the illegals coming in while they continue to enforce their racial mixing and their anti-discrimination laws. Their aim is to homogenize the population and destroy its white character gradually without provoking an uprising. Or consider Bill Clinton's current campaign to have more legislation enacted against so-called hate crimes. This may score a few votes from black, homosexual, and feminist voters for the Democrats. But the Democrats were getting all of those votes anyway. As I have explained in other broadcasts, Mr. Clinton's campaign to outlaw hate makes very little sense if it is taken at face value. It is understandable only in the context of a much larger campaign to scrap the Bill of Rights. In fact, what we see when we look closely at the principal backers of the New World Order and at the people who have been loudest in their demands for curbs on First Amendment rights, in their demands for the elimination of all Second Amendment rights, and in their calls for governmental behavior contrary to the Fourth, Fifth, and Sixth Amendments as well, all in the name of increasing public security. What we see is that these are the same people. The people who want to outlaw what they call hate speech, the people who want to confiscate all private firearms, the people who believe that political correctness should take precedence over the right to due process and a speedy trial, to freedom from double jeopardy and from being compelled to testify against oneself and from unlawful search and seizure. All these people are fervent promoters of the New World Order. And all of the people who have been scheming for the New World Order understand that the one thing which could upset their apple cart is a rebellion by white patriots. And they're determined to have the government tighten its grip on the people in order to prevent a rebellion from taking place. Now, I apologize for not having enough time to present more details today, for not carefully documenting everything I've said today with plenty of evidence. But you know, I've done that on other American Dissident Voices broadcasts. On one broadcast or another, I've documented everything I've said today. I wanted to put it all together for you today, to give you the big picture in broad outline. Now, I'll tell you what it means for our future. It means, first and foremost, that the government's assault on our freedom will not abate. Instead, it will become more intense, more vicious, more reckless. The government lawlessness that we saw at Ruby Ridge and at Waco will intensify. The government is irrevocably committed to repressing dissent, to stifling opposition, to intimidating its critics, and to locking up or killing everyone who cannot be intimidated. The New World Order schemers are absolutely determined to have their way. They have been able to go a long way toward their goal by using subterfuge and deceit. But ultimately, the transformation of a world of independent nations into the global plantation they are aiming at will involve changes so profound and so traumatic that subterfuge and deceit will not be enough to keep the serfs under control. They will need raw police power applied KGB style. They have to develop that power and begin using it now. They must silence their critics. They're a pretty bold and arrogant bunch of schemers, but they understand that according to the old way of looking at things, according to our way, they are traitors. They understand that if the general public ever gets a real inkling of what they are up to, if they ever lose their grip on the situation, they'll all end up hanging from lampposts. What they are planning is so monstrous, so evil, that the thought of being brought to account for it frightens them. And in their fear, they will resort to every means at their disposal to protect themselves and their scheme. And, my friends, we will resort to every means at our disposal to ensure that their scheme does not succeed and that they do indeed end up hanging from lampposts. I am counting on your help. Thanks for being with me again today.
Dr. William Luther Pierce on Understanding Our Enemies, 1996.
Hello. We talked a couple of months ago about the exploitation by the government and the media of black church burnings. We discussed the way in which the Clinton administration and the controlled news media were claiming these burnings were the work of organized white racists without a shred of evidence to support their claim. I pointed out in my earlier broadcast that it was possible that a couple of boozed-up Kluxers might have started one or two of the fires, but that as many blacks as whites had been arrested in the burnings, that collecting insurance money was a more likely motive than racism, and that it was very unlikely that any organized white group was involved. As time passes, it becomes clearer that our analysis of the situation was on target, and that of the government and the media was not. Sure enough, the government has arrested a couple of Kluxers for burning two churches, and sure enough, they've been unable to find any white racist conspiracy, no matter how hard they've tried. I suspect the issue of burning black churches will now fade quietly into the background, just like a thousand other phony issues before it. Another of these phony issues was the painting of swastikas on the barracks doors of several black soldiers' rooms at the Army's Fort Bragg in North Carolina a few weeks ago. The politicians and the media raised another big hullabaloo about white racism in the military and called for a new crackdown on what they like to call hate crimes. The military brass were so panicked
by the media fuss that white soldiers were confined to their barracks while the matter was being investigated. When it turned out that two black soldiers had done the swastika painting, the issue quietly faded away. The people in the media who had been making the biggest fuss about white racism before the two blacks were caught weren't even embarrassed. They weren't even embarrassed. They just moved on to another phony issue and kept beating the drums about white racism. Now, one of the reasons why these media people weren't embarrassed is that many of them belong to a race which is biologically incapable of feeling shame. And the ones who don't belong to that race have trained themselves to think and behave just like their Jewish bosses. That's one of the reasons for the shameless behavior of the controlled media. The more important reason, however, is one that I mentioned briefly in my earlier talk with you. The criminals in the government and in the media who have been lying to us and taking advantage of us and wrecking our society for so long now are desperate to keep normal, decent, working white men and women morally disarmed, to keep us on the defensive, to keep us feeling guilty and confused. Because they know that if we ever begin thinking clearly, if we ever take stock of our situation, if we ever decide to straighten out the mess they've made of things, there will be hell to pay. They know that if white Americans ever wake up and get their act together, most of the media bosses and the politicians won't live more than a day or two before they're hunted down and dealt with. Let's look at the details of what's happening. I talked a little about this earlier, but we need to go over it again and again until everyone understands it. One of the things we talked about before was that it's not just the media criminals and the politicians who want to keep us morally disarmed. It's the whole Clinton coalition, including the ones who vote Republican. It's all of the freaks and the perverts and the minorities who see their own interests tied to the status quo. It's everyone who can't make it on his own in a normal, healthy society and so depends on the government in one way or another. It's the members of the welfare class who've come to believe that they really deserve to be supported by the rest of us and who realize that they'll be strictly on their own and will have to either work or starve if the productive people ever reassert themselves. It's the crazed feminists who are afraid that they won't be able to be Air Force generals or military school cadets or top corporate executives if the government's drive to ban traditional sex roles is halted. It's the homosexuals and other degenerates who depend on a police state to force people to tolerate their behavior. It's the members of all the non-white minorities, the blacks and the mestizos and the Asians and the rest, who know they'll be sent packing to live among their own kind instead of continuing to drag us down into a multiracial and multicultural and mongrelized chaos. All of these people have an instinctive understanding that they have to keep us feeling sorry for them, feeling guilty for wanting to be rid of them, feeling too confused to look out for the interests of our own people, our own civilization. They know that if we ever regain our wits, their goose will be cooked. Finally, there's one other bunch of people who have an interest in keeping normal, working white men and women confused with lies about black church burnings and swastika-painted barracks doors. Those are the liberal trendies who grew up during the Vietnam era and now are heavily entrenched in the government, the media, and the educational establishment. During the Vietnam conflict, the Jewish leaders of Students for a Democratic Society, Americans for Democratic Action, the National Student Association, the Student Mobilization Committee, and 100 other leftist organizations were using the war as a pretext to turn American society upside down. These groups had virtually taken over the university campuses in America because the university administrators were afraid that they would be accused of anti-Semitism if they took a stand against them. And the trendy airheads on the campuses, who had been spoiled rotten by a permissive upbringing, easily fell for the propaganda of these organizations, which essentially told them that they could do whatever they wanted to and had no responsibility to anyone or anything. In particular, they could avoid military service and continue smoking dope, partying, and going to rock concerts. These were the Bill Clinton types, the rotten, selfish little bastards who got a big kick out of parading around with Viet Cong flags and thumbing their noses at mommy, daddy, and their country. Not all of them grew up to be chosen president of the United States by the media and the political bosses, but they did grow up to have a powerful grip on our schools and other institutions. They are still irresponsible. They are still essentially hedonist in their outlook. They still believe that they should be able to get away with anything so long as the government, now in their hands, won't let mommy and daddy spank them for it. Of course, that's just a figure of speech. These liberals, now approaching middle age, aren't really worried any longer about being spanked for making mud pies or smoking dope or having Viet Cong flags in their dormitory rooms. But they are worried that if normal, decent, responsible white Americans ever get the upper hand again, the aging liberal trendies will be dragged out of their offices and their condos and their country clubs and beaten to within a quarter inch of their lives for the mess they've made of things, for what they've done to our world, to the heritage that our ancestors struggled and bled to preserve. They're worried that a lot of them will end up swinging from the end of a rope. And believe me, that's a well-justified worry. So all of this is why we keep having our faces rubbed in white guilt with phony white racist conspiracies to burn black churches or intimidate black soldiers with swastikas. This is why we're lied to by the government and the media. This is why Bill Clinton wants to shut down radio programs which are critical of the government. This is why the media folks become hysterical whenever new signs of popular opposition to the government become visible, whether in the form of a terrorist bombing or a group merely wanting to be left alone, like the Branch Davidians or the Montana Freemen. It's why we have a major assault underway on the First and Second Amendments by left-wing academics who want to limit what we can say and also take away our means to protect our right to say it. It's why any questioning of even the most far-fetched Holocaust claims or any comment about the Jewish control of the mass media or any scientific inquiry into racial differences or any public statement which might offend feminists or homosexuals or non-whites brings such an intolerant, closed-minded, and spiteful response from the liberal Jewish media government sector. It's an attack on their coalition. It may be a sign that we're waking up. Remember what they did to poor Marge Schott when she made a couple of comments they deemed offensive? They really are afraid that we'll wake up. They really are desperate to keep us confused, demoralized, and on the defensive. They know that if we ever go on the offensive, they will be finished. Our job, the task of American dissident voices, is to wake our people up, to help them straighten out their thinking, to give them moral courage again, and to prepare them to take the offensive. That is a formidable task. The majority of our people have let themselves be convinced that a normal, healthy, instinctive racial attitude, the desire to live and work and play and mate with one's own kind, what our enemies call racism, is wicked. Our enemies call this healthy, natural racial attitude a sickness. They have been able to make many of us feel guilty for having such an attitude, much like the prudes of a century ago were able to make many people feel guilty for having a normal, healthy interest in the opposite sex. So we can understand the motives of the elements who are destroying America and destroying our people, the motives of the filthy creatures who are deliberately sapping the will of our people to resist this destruction by pumping poisonous propaganda into our minds. We can understand their motives. They want to live too, but their way of life is to suck out our life blood, to cling like leeches to our society and warp it to fit their needs. And they know that they can only do this by keeping us confused and morally debilitated. They know that if we become morally healthy again, they will die. We can understand that. We can even understand how they accomplish their destructive work. We can understand both the organizational aspects and the psychological aspects. It's easy enough to understand why the controlled media are so ferociously determined to keep the flood of third world immigrants pouring across our borders, why they become hysterical whenever anyone suggests restricting immigration, and why the government refuses to do more than make the flimsiest pretext of guarding our borders. Every Mexican and every Haitian and every Vietnamese and every Chinaman who sneaks into the country is a new member of their coalition against white America. There are other aspects of this numbers problem too. Every sexually confused kid who grows up in one of these modern, mixed-up families without strong sexual role models and ends up being lured into the homosexual lifestyle is a new recruit for their coalition. That helps us understand the hatred that the Clintonistas have for the traditional family and for traditional sex roles. It's the psychological war our enemies have been waging against us, which we must address before we can hope to do much about their efforts to outnumber us and divide us, however. We white people have a fatal compulsion to be nice, to try very hard not to give offense or hurt the feelings of others. Actually, this compulsion wasn't a bad trait in past centuries when our society was racially and culturally homogeneous. It's a trait which serves as a social lubricant, minimizing conflict and abetting cooperation. But it really has been used against us by Jews and other non-whites now living among us. There are far too many of our people who are bright enough to understand what's happening to our world, but who just can't bring themselves to say or do anything about it because they've let themselves be persuaded that that would be bad manners. It's rude to talk about racial differences because if a non-white overheard it, his feelings might be hurt. It's not polite to discuss the effects on our society of Jewish media control because such a discussion is offensive to Jews. Does it hurt our feelings to be called honky or goy or gringo? Not really. We listen without objection to the most scathing criticism of our people and our ways by aliens, but we are afraid to criticize them for fear of hurting their feelings. Republican presidential candidate Bob Dole has told us that he won't even use the word alien in talking about the immigration problem because he's afraid that would be offensive to aliens who don't like to be reminded of their irregular status. It will be a real struggle for some of us to put racial survival ahead of politeness. In addition to convincing us that any discussion of the real issues we are facing would be bad manners, our enemies have made good use of the psychological trick of pretending to be weak and helpless because they have discovered that we have a trait apparently unique among the races of man, of feeling sorry for those who are helpless. When we are confronted with an obviously dangerous and aggressive enemy who scowls and threatens as he advances toward us with a weapon, we know what to do. But if that same enemy shuffles toward us with his eyes averted and his hat in his hands, begging for a little welfare, we feel guilty for even thinking about chasing him away or killing him, no matter how strongly we would like to avoid his company. Try that trick in Africa or Asia, and it will get you killed in a hurry. But in Europe and North America, it works. Some of us are so overwhelmed with feelings of racial guilt after being pumped full of propaganda about how our ancestors mistreated the defenseless brown man and the helpless black man and the poor inoffensive Jew, that we have become moral basket cases and can't defend ourselves today, even when we can see all around us the depredations that non-whites are making against our people. And so now we can understand the reason for all of the headlines in the controlled media about hate crimes by white skinheads against poor, inoffensive non-whites in our cities today, and for all of the Hollywood films about the way the wicked white settlers abused the unsuspecting and unresisting Indians a century ago. Now we can understand why they invent white racist conspiracies to burn down black churches. They play on our reluctance to give offense, on our inability to resist an aggressor who pretends to be helpless, and on the ease with which we can be morally paralyzed by artificially induced feelings of guilt. These are powerful weapons they use against us. They use them with diabolical skill. And all of us have felt the powerful temptation, even when we understood what they were doing to us, just to be nice, not to resist, not to oppose them. What they are doing to us is almost hypnotic. It is so easy for you to remain asleep, they tell us. It is so easy just to let us have our way, their propaganda tells us. It is so easy just to let your people die. Let your civilization fall into ruin. Let us have it all. No one will blame you for that, they smile. That's the polite way. Don't resist us. Just let us have it all. That's the way to soothe your guilt. That's the way to avoid criticism. That's the nice way. Over and over and over again, that's their message for us. Don't resist. And then more guilt-inducing stories about the Jewish Holocaust, about burning black churches, and about white terrorists. And then heartwarming stories about struggling third world immigrants working hard to achieve the American dream, over and over and over. Yes, we understand these tactics of our enemies. Understanding them is not the same as overcoming them, of course, but understanding is a necessary first step. What we must do after we have wiped the sleep from our eyes and flushed our enemies' poisonous propaganda from our minds is re-establish contact with our instinct, with our inner wisdom. That wisdom will tell us that the guilt we feel because our ancestors did what they thought was necessary to protect our people, to gain new living space for us, and to build the civilization that we inherited for them, that is false guilt. One does not become guilty for doing anything which is necessary or helpful for the survival or progress of one's people in this competitive and unforgiving world. Guilt comes from failing to accept the responsibility we have to our own people. Guilt comes from letting ourselves be deceived by our enemies. Guilt comes from losing the struggle for survival. And our inner wisdom also will tell us that we can be polite once again. We can concern ourselves with not hurting anyone's feelings once again when we have cleared away the last threat to our people and once more are living only among ourselves. And with this wisdom guiding us, we will be immune to the deceit of our enemies, and we will overcome them. Thanks for being with me again today.
Dr. William Luther Pierce, 1998, Nationalism versus the New World Order.
Hello. An interesting thing happened a few days ago. The government of India detonated 5 nuclear warheads in underground tests, and the establishment in the United States reacted with shock and dismay. This is good news for at least 6 reasons. I'll tell you why, one reason at a time. First, the nuclear tests were a complete surprise to the Clinton government. That's a wonderful proof of the fallibility of government for those of you inclined to believe that you can't fight City Hall because City Hall has the secret police working on its side and the secret police know everything. Our Central Intelligence Agency spends $27 billion a year to be aware of what's happening around the world, including the building of facilities for making nuclear warheads and other weapons of mass destruction. And the CIA didn't have a clue. Of course, an even better scenario would be that the CIA knew but kept it a secret from the Clinton administration. That, however, is unlikely, since the head spook is himself a Clintonista, and this Indian episode could cost him his job. The important thing that the Indian tests prove is that for all of its repressiveness and all of its money and all of its jackbooted federal thugs and all of its wiretaps and subpoenas and paid informers, the Washington government can be outsmarted by intelligent and determined patriots, not by a bunch of boozed-up yahoos who make their plans in the local bar, but by intelligent, disciplined, and determined patriots. The second reason India's nuclear tests last week were good news is that they let a lot of air out of the principal excuse given by the Clinton government for its campaign against Iraq, which nearly led us into another war in the Persian Gulf a few weeks ago, and which will lead us into a war yet if the Jews and the Clintonistas have their way. That excuse for the campaign against Iraq is that we must keep weapons of mass destruction under tight control. We must keep Iraq from developing such weapons because then we won't have control over them. Of course, India's demonstration that we've already lost control won't stop the Clintonistas from continuing to use their argument about the danger of letting Iraq develop weapons of mass destruction. But as I said, that argument will seem a bit flat now to those who had let themselves be persuaded that it was necessary for the security of everyone to keep the genie tightly corked up in his bottle. Clearly, the genie is out, and bombing Iraq into the Stone Age won't put him back. The third reason India's nuclear tests are good news is that all of the hullabaloo about countries developing nuclear weapons without permission from the United Nations should remind everyone that the most egregious example of such outlaw nuclear development is that of Israel. The controlled media, of course, have been covering for Israel, but the more fuss they make about India, the more questions thoughtful people will have about Israel. The hypocrisy of the treatment by the Washington government and the media of the whole topic of controlling weapons of mass destruction should become more apparent. Obviously, the policy of preventing unstable countries from acquiring nuclear or biological weapons is a sham. The failure to apply the policy in the case of Israel, the deliberate failure to halt Israel's development of a nuclear arsenal when the U.S. government knew that development was occurring, undermined the moral basis for the policy long ago. And we should not be surprised that no one takes it seriously today. The fourth reason we should be glad for India's nuclear tests is that they are a big psychological setback for the New World Order crowd. The liberals, the Jews, and the other New World Order boosters have worked hard to create the impression that the coming of the New World Order is irresistible. It is a steamroller, and you'd better not get in its way or you'll be squashed. The impressionable masses have let themselves be persuaded to go along for the ride, even if they aren't especially enthusiastic. One of the consolations in their eyes is the promise of security and certainty. Once the New World Order is solidly in place, no one anywhere will be able to do anything without permission from the people pulling the strings at the United Nations. And so there will be no more wars or other nasty surprises, and the masses can get on with being obedient consumers and television viewers without having to worry about making any difficult decisions. So now India has shown us that the New World Order is quite resistible after all. India has thumbed its nose at all of the people who've been assuring us that national sovereignty is passé and that in the future everyone must do whatever the UN bosses say. So what are the Clintonistas and the Jews going to do about this little rebuff India has given them? Send a few aircraft carriers to the Indian Ocean and threaten New Delhi with cruise missiles? Not likely. It's a bit easier to push Iraq around than India, with its billion citizens and a continent to itself. The head New World Order gangster in the United States, Bill Clinton, says that India will be punished economically for daring to stand in the way of his gang. And undoubtedly, that's what will happen. Even if the head gangster changes his mind, the economic sanctions already have been written into law. And these attempts to punish India by cutting off trade, blocking loans, and other economic measures are the fifth reason why India's nuclear tests are good news. The Jews can get away with their starvation embargo against Iraq, but that sort of thing just won't work against India. On the contrary, it will have several good effects on the Indian people. It will teach them the virtue of self-sufficiency and strengthen their sense of nationalism and their determination to be masters in their own house. In fact, as soon as the threat of economic punishment was raised last week, the Indians expressed their defiance and their contempt for any American efforts to make them conform to UN policy. The Hindus always have been wary of the Jews. Back during the Second World War, when they were still under the colonial thumb of the British Empire, Hindu nationalists were sympathetic toward Germany, and they learned from the Germans many lessons about the Jews, lessons which have not been entirely forgotten. Economic sanctions against them now by the Jews' American lapdog will confirm the Hindus' antipathy toward the people who believe that their God chose them to rule the world. The more economic pressure Bill Clinton tries to bring against India, the more determined Indians will be to cut any dependence on the United Nations and become completely self-sufficient. All of that is very good. Furthermore, because many American consumer goods are now imported from India. There should be some substantial economic dislocations in the United States if Mr. Clinton starts a trade war with India. And this should help everyone to see better just how uncertain and shaky is the whole concept of a global economy. This is a good time to remember what I consider one of the most important and fundamental rules of historical development. And that rule is, decisive historical events always catch many people by surprise. And the people most likely to be caught by surprise are the smart asses who thought they had everything under control. Many decent people today are discouraged and pessimistic about the future because they believe that the enemies of our people have an unbreakable grip on the course of events. Decent people see the media almost completely under the control of the Jews. They see the Jews all around Clinton running most of the important branches of the U.S. government, the State Department, the Treasury Department, the Defense Department. They see similar situations with the governments in Britain and Russia and Germany and France, everyone bowing and scraping to the Jews, every important politician in their pockets, everyone afraid to call them to account for their crimes. They see the destruction already wrought among our own people by the Jews' policies. White kids hooked on MTV and behaving like blacks. Non-white immigrants continuing to pour into the country, and the threat of a non-white majority in America in the next few decades. And they see the Jews continuing to implement their master plan for a global plantation, with themselves as God's chosen overseers, the rest of the world's population as their obedient serfs, and United Nations peacekeeping forces always ready to put down any insurrection by the disarmed serfs. Decent people see these things, and they believe the Jews have everything under control. Many of them consequently become discouraged, and they give up. And so the sixth reason why the Indian nuclear tests are good news for decent people everywhere is that they serve as an encouraging reminder of the fundamental rule of historical development I mentioned a moment ago. Nothing about the future is certain except that the smart asses will be caught by surprise, no matter how tightly they think they have things under control. And it really is a major upset of the kosher apple cart when India, with its 1 billion people and its own strategically located subcontinent, tells the Jews to take their new world order and stop it. And even more kosher apples are likely to be rolling in the gutter before the Jews have time to pick up the ones spilled by the Indians. India has had ongoing border disputes with both Pakistan and China for some time. Both of these countries will have a strong incentive now to tell the arms control people from the United Nations to go to hell and to resume the development of their own nuclear arsenals. This is an especially promising prospect in the case of Pakistan, which, as an Islamic country, has close bonds of sympathy with the Palestinians, the Iraqis, the Iranians, and the other Islamic peoples opposed to Israel's aggression in the Middle East. Every development which thwarts Washington's role as the Jews' global bully boy and enforcer is a good development. There are just two components of the Jews' power. One is money, and the other is their control of public opinion through their control of the news and entertainment media. In the West, they are able to use both their money and their media control to retain their power. They use their money to buy politicians, and they use their media control to keep the general public more or less hypnotized and aimed in the direction they want. In the East, the Jews don't control the mass media and are not able to keep the Asian masses hypnotized. But they nevertheless have been able to use their money to corrupt Asian governments. That is, they have been able to use our money for that purpose. They have been able to use American foreign aid money and loans from various international banks and the giveaway or sale of military hardware to keep the politicians of the third world more or less under control. If Saudi Arabia wants to buy American jets for its Air Force, then it must promise not to make any problems for Israel. If some black potentate in Africa is encroaching on an Oppenheimer mining operation, then a few million dollars in foreign aid from the U.S. Treasury will make him mend his ways and keep his black hands off the Chosen One's diamond mines. That's the way it always has worked. There's just one thing in the third world or anywhere which can beat the Jews' money power, and that thing is nationalism. That's why the Jews, all of them, have such a hatred for every nationalism but their own, for every nationalism except Zionism. When India was ruled by the thoroughly corrupt and democratic Congress Party, the Jews were able to keep the Indians more or less under control. But in March of this year, the Hindu nationalists won control of the Indian government. And for the nationalists, independence is more important than all of the comforts money can buy. That's why India's new nationalist prime minister is willing to defy the Jews and do without American money. The Jews, of course, still will try to use their money power, that is, their control over our public funds, to bribe the Indians and others back into line. The first thing which the Clinton government announced after the Indian nuclear tests was that it was reconsidering its hold on Pakistan's purchase of American military aircraft. The sale had been held up because of Jewish objections to letting an Islamic country buy modern military aircraft. Now, says the Clinton government, if the Pakistanis will forego any nuclear tests of their own, maybe they can have the aircraft after all. And similar bribes will be offered to China and to India. The Chinese will be told that if they don't react the wrong way to the Indian nuclear tests, then their exports of machine tools and shoes to the United States won't be jeopardized in the future because of piddling little things like human rights violations. As I said, these bribes usually have worked for the Jews in the past, and their money power is what they're counting on to keep the world moving toward their goal of a kosher global plantation. Nationalism is the one force which can thwart them, the one political ideology active on a large scale in the world today in which money is not the primary concern. That is why any success by nationalists anywhere in the world today, any declaration of independence from the global plantation, is good news for decent, freedom-loving people everywhere. It is good news when it happens in Germany or Hungary or France, but it is especially good news when it happens in a place like India, which is big enough and sufficiently free from Jewish influence to be able to put a significant monkey wrench into the gears of the New World Order's machinery of global enslavement. You know, we are not nationalists in the old-fashioned sense, in the sense of geographical nationalism. We don't belong to the USA right or wrong crowd, which considers any featherless biped claiming U.S. citizenship, regardless of race, color, or creed, as a compatriot. Our nationalism is really racial nationalism. Our compatriots are our fellow white men and women, our fellow Europeans everywhere, in America, in Europe, in Southern Africa, in Australia. Nationalism, in our sense, racial nationalism, is still a relatively new thing as a political ideology, although it is based on instincts much older than any ideology. A lot of people, conservatives especially, are still much more comfortable with the old-fashioned sort of nationalism, or with an ethnic nationalism which is much more limited in scope than our racial nationalism. Conservatives are more comfortable with Scottish nationalism or German nationalism or Polish nationalism. And that's all right. We encourage these more limited ethnic nationalisms at this time. We encourage any nationalism which is not anti-European or anti-white. We even welcome black nationalism or Hindu nationalism or Chinese nationalism, because nationalists of every variety are facing a much bigger threat today than any rival nationalism. Intelligent Hindu nationalists understand that Irish nationalists and Ukrainian nationalists and Swedish nationalists need not be hostile to them, and we understand that too. Every national group which is concerned with preserving itself, with preserving its unique racial characteristics, its unique language, its unique culture and traditions and lifestyles, is the natural ally of every other nationally conscious group at a time when all of us are faced with a threat of the Jews' New World Order. Once the Jews have realized their global plantation, a plantation without national boundaries, with a homogenized population, a homogenized culture, and a uniform standard of living for the serfs, every nationality will be lost permanently in the mass. Now is the time to derail this nightmare scheme for global subjugation. And any nationality, Hindu or other, which helps in derailing it by whatever means, deserves our praise and any assistance we can provide. The prospect of a nuclear arms race between India, China, and Pakistan may not seem very encouraging, but it is a far brighter prospect than a continuation of the process of globalization being promoted by the Jews and their allies, whether international capitalists or deranged liberals. So, for all of the reasons I have mentioned, India's detonation of nuclear weapons is very good news indeed for decent, freedom-loving patriots everywhere. Thanks for being with me again today.